session of April 20, 1977. We still have 3 meetings today, April 27th, the last meeting May 4th. In this exchange of letters with the audience, someone mentioned the food consumed in the confined woman of Poitiers. This confined woman would have a particular diet of hot chocolate and a cake called a Jesuit. I needed to check what this cake was. I was given a few clarifications. The precisions are a little enigmatic. In one version, this cake called Jesuit is a cake filled with almond paste. Another version is that it looks like a chocolate cake, but inside it's made up of layers of chocolate and meringue. The cake hides what it is. It's careful not to show its hand. I would incline to that definition. Dark chocolate is like the black of the Jesuits, as one can see in Stendhal's The Red and the Black. I now come to a few last figures. It's a short one. It has a specific name, the name of proxemics. Proxemics. To explain what it is, I'll start from an everyday gesture. It's night time, I get into bed, I turn off the light, I lie back under the covers to go to sleep. But then I need to blow my nose. In darkness, I reach out and I successfully locate the top drawer of my bedside table. I open the drawer and, with the same assurance, find the handkerchief on the right-hand side. I put it back, close the drawer again, just like that. This kind of episode enables us to formulate a notion of proxemics. The term was a neologism, proxemics. It was coined by Edward Twitchell Hall in 1966. It was translated in 1971, La Dimension Cachée, The Hidden Dimension. Proxemics is the interrelated observations and theories of man's use of space as a specialized elaboration of culture. There is a dialectics of distance. For my part, I shall restrict my use of the word to the very localized space of the subject's immediate surroundings. Proxemics refers to the familiar space, the space of objects that can be easily reached blindly, almost without moving, without having to get up, as in the privileged space of sleep, of rest, the kind of work you can do at home. Abraham Mose has studied the sphere of direct gesture. In his book, Perception of Habitation, the cubic meter of space within reach of an immobile body. It's a microspace. The examples provided by Moles are a child in his cart, a businessman in his office, an intellectual at his desk, the pensioner in his armchair with television, pipe, spectacles, newspapers. Proxemics belong to a typology of subjective spaces.
Alors la proxémie ferait partie d'une typologie des espaces subjectifs.
These are subjective spaces inhabited by the subject.
Il faut bien comprendre qu'à ce moment-là, cet espace proxémique est un microespace.
This proxemic space, that's a microspace.
Comment dirais-je, de liste descendante des espaces
a successor to domains or territories inhabited by man. We've met this several times in the territory. We have more restricted spaces like the hideout, the smaller. The hideout is the room, Robinson Crusoe's hut, the colonist's apartment in the mysterious island. We have to remember this definition of Chambard: family. Is a group of people living under the shelter of a single key. They depend upon a single key. If we go down even more, the proxemic space is the niche or the nest. It's the need, the nest, in a certain sense, the space of your field of vision, of smell, of hearing, then where things can be seen. Going down, we find things that are hidden, then when things are reached for, when things are touched in a nest. Two objects that are manufactured are natural generators of proxemics. These are the lamp and the bed. These are central objects that the subject tends to identify with. And now discuss the lamp. Just say a few words about the lamp. It's an object center, a crystallizer of proxemics. The lamp can be inscribed in a family of objects. These are varied over history. For centuries, you'd had as the center for man, the hearth, the fireplace, the source of heat. It was a symbolism of fire. In an old house, I experienced this in my childhood, it was the stove. there was no central heating. The stove was less proximal than a wood fire. There was a crystallization of space via odor, a soft flickering light, the flickering fire as an ever-changing spectacle of incidents. There's always something happening. Today, this, if we can be a little refined in the analysis, is replaced by television. It tends to serve the same purpose. Straddling those two regimes, there is an important object, a generator of sedentary microspace between the fire and the screen. That object is the lamp. The lamp is taken up in a style of civilization. You had, first of all, at the beginning, just a light bulb, a naked light bulb. This is what happened in communal rooms in farmhouses, may still happen today. Then, the lamp at a higher degree was suspended from the ceiling. It's the moment of the petit bourgeois dining room. Finally, the lamp itself, that coincides with the suppression of the central ceiling light. There would be a whole history of lighting. A diachrony that could still be actualized, for instance, if you take a train journey, you are plunged into different interior spaces, each corresponding to a different phase of civilization. You see the suburbs, you see the city. Proxemics differ with each phase of civilization. In the light bulb at ceiling height, you have no proxemics, no interiority to the interior. No interiority at all. Secondly, if you have a light bulb suspended from the ceiling, this is the beginning of proxemics. This is familial proxemics. Around the dinner table, it retains its proxemical function, even once the plates have been cleared, reading the paper, doing homework, playing games, you have the same proxemical space for the familial life. Finally, the lamp is a strong proxemics. It isolates the writing desk, the armchair. It produces a lit being and a dark nothingness. Through a paradoxical but logical reversal, it's in complete darkness that the habitual gesture is exposed. I don't even need to see to feel proxemics. Darkness can create the very essence of proxemics. There are tests about proxemics, subjective tests,
faut dire que, bien sûr, si je fais une figure de la prosémie, c'est que je me connais moi-même comme...
I know myself well, so I can do a figure of my proxemics. If I can test it, for instance, if I go somewhere else, if I go to a hotel, in a hotel, I perceive as unpleasant the other new things. This can be in a hotel room with obscurity that disguises everything. This is similar to what the company of sleeping wagons has reconstituted with sleeping berths on an overnight train. They give you the feeling that you are in your bed, you have your own light, you have a rack for your things, you have a nail to hang your watch. Second object that's a crystallizer of proxemics is the bed, the sick bed in particular, the strongest form of proxemics. I remember having seen in a magazine of Matisse at the end of his life, who was very sick, couldn't move, in bed, and he had a very long bedside table, and a board on his knees on which he could draw and paint. It was very organized space because he was motionless in the middle. The typical example in Proust is Aunt Leonie's bed. On the one hand, you have the windows facing the street. On the other hand, there's a yellow dresser and a table that serves as dispensary and altar. Tante Léonie has gone through all the different stages of proxemics. The territory, the hideout, the nest. She declined to leave first Cambrai, the territory, then her house, the hideout, then her bed, the nest. The bed is the very essence of proxemics. It's a part of the body, a prosthesis. The body is experienced in bed as a fifth limb. This limb in the body, the body itself is like an organ at rest in bed. Monks of Mount Athos, before monasteries were established, one forgets they possessed nothing. They had nowhere to live, no belongings. They would travel by foot, carrying the sole item of furniture on their backs, the mats they slept on at night. Another feature Spinoza's curious attachment to his bed. Upon his father's death, his objects were shared out among the children. However, when the partition came to be effected, he left his brothers and sisters everything. He reserved only one bed, in truth a very good one, and the items around it. Spinoza would be a philosopher of proxemics. The bed is, of course, a marvelous object. Is the site of the subject's phantasmatic expansion. The subject fantasizes through reading. Then, in some cases, if possible, through a window, the subject can be called. Bed is a comfortable looking post. Leonie watches the street from her bed. She sees people going in and out of the grocers. Third, through phantasmatic fabulation, Leonie invents imaginary plots to entertain herself. She's still in her bed. And she's enthralled by all those plots. Proust called this the spectacle in a bed. There could be the typology, subjects who have a certain relationship with their beds. As a symbol of laziness, there could be a rich, multifunctional relationship to the bed. On the other hand, subjects who have no relationship whatever to their beds. The bed is an indifferent, impersonal, functional object. In other words, subjects who need to establish a form of proxemics in order to be able to work are opposed to subjects who can work anywhere without worrying. In my interviews, I've indicated several times the problem that is rarely discussed of the proxemic space of work. There would be a typology to establish here. Given the investment one can have in the immediate surroundings when you work, accessories, places, objects, it can be organized systematically, or it can be left completely open. You can write in a cafe table with any kind of pen or paper. And I tackle another figure. It has the name of rectangle. I start from this remark. We have a civilization of the rectangle. We have already discussed living spaces. Look at the spaces we live in. Just think about it. Look, there's a majority of angles that are at 90 and 180 degrees. Houses, in apartments, in buildings, everything is a rectangle. The doors, the windows, the roofs, the elevators. In nature, with lots of scare quotes, it can exist, nature. There are no rectangles in nature, except for a few rocks. Since we now associate the city, living space, humanity and pollution, there's a pollution affected by the rectangle. It's a polluting figure. The agents of that pollution are quite simply architects. For a long time, architects
instituer et maintenu la tyrannie de ce qu'on appelle publiquement les tracés régulateurs.
Architects have perpetuated the tyranny of regulatory lines. Every architect should use them, Le Corbusier. Of course, reason would agree with the shape of the rectangle. The rectangle is reasonable. This is from the Greek. We have opposed the hut or to the tent. It's circular and radial. Who knows? There might be an ideology of the rectangle. We might then connect the rectangle with what we'll see soon, the origins of the word, the etymology in Greek, rex. Rex is somebody who draws straight lines. Rex is the king, is also a religious person. He draws lines. The rectangle would be the basic shape of the king's power. Would be a simple form of power. Now I'm going to move on to the frame. There are two investigation themes, two facts that expose the wholly artificial nature of the rectangle. The rectangle is a historical object that can be neurotic. Both themes have to do with the relation between the rectangle and the image, with the creation of the image, the imagery. As you know, if you know the arts, is the archetype of the pictorial frame. The image is put into a frame. We are used to seeing images in a certain frame. We never see an image without framing it. Quadrato means square. The square is the pure, abstract, even esoteric version of the rectangle. the cadre to which we've been accustomed, is the condition for our perception of some images. To frame an image is a relatively late practice. Earlier, images were not framed. In prehistoric art, in cave paintings, you have no frame. The idea of framing only intervened in the 2nd century BC. It's just a file to open, something to study. This has been discussed in a dissertation, and Meyer Shapiro has written about the rectangularization of the image. The rectangular frame beyond the painting is something that corresponds to an Italian scene. It's also what we see in film. Everywhere we find the problem of the rectangle. In the psychic economy, we have a similar phenomenon. Meyer Shapiro has written, such a field of the rectangle corresponds to nothing in nature or in mental imagery, where the phantoms of visual memory appear one after another in one unending wave. That's not quite right. Not always right. In mental imagery, we often have recourse to the rectangular frame image. Specifically, in certain episodes of imaginary activity, the kind that engages the subject in a certain language, there is an inner frame and it builds the image. There is a need for a frame if we want to keep a mental image. I discussed this in a seminar on love. I have the theory of the framing of the image. The fact that the subject can be completely kidnapped, enamored, enchanted by an image is generally a captivation by a framed image. The object of love, or the object to be loved, abruptly appears as a cutout silhouette or as a particular detail, a fetishizable part of the body. Then, in a frame, in a setting, this is why on the cover of my book on Lover's Discourse, I had the detail and it was the type of an amorous image. Then the vision of the loved object is a vision in a frame. And third, the loved object, the object of ravishment, is always shown in situation. It was only in fairy tales that a subject can fall in love with somebody who is not framed. It's hard to fall in love with somebody who doesn't do anything. We could talk about love at first sight, Charlotte, and bread and butter framed by the doorway. This was in Werther. This is how Werther falls in love when he sees Charlotte in the door, in a rectangle. Famous episode in Werther. In the Wolfman, in Freud's Wolfman, he falls in love with maids, the young maid Grusha is working. She is on all fours and she washes the floor. Third example, the example of Gradiva, when she's walking, one foot raised in a bas relief. In Freud's famous analysis of Jensen's novel, the bas-relief is a type of rectangle, and she's doing something since she's walking with one foot raised, the one who is walking. There is a reality of the rectangle in the imaginary field. Last question for the rectangle. How, if you try, can one subvert the rectangle? This is again an immense dossier. It includes the theatrical arts, plastic arts, painting, sculpture, architecture, film, cartoons. This would entail a re-examination of the function of what is the opposite of the rectangle. The round, the rounded. One would have to analyze the circle in so far as it replaces the square. In the paradigm of the circle as opposed to the rectangle. This is here a rapid division of the dossier. In the Theater of Antiquity, we have a circular theater with the Greeks, the orchestra is completely circular. The Latin theater was semicircular, half a circle. What was called the stage at first was just a tent for the actors. They would just get dressed, come out of it, perform on the stage. They played in front of the scene, the proscenium. It changed finally. The stage then became a square or a rectangle. All the theater as a space testifies to the struggle between the rectangle and the circus, the circle. There could be now a return to the rounded. Second point, as the subversion of the rectangle, we have the attempts to break the frame. From Cézanne to Chinese painting, one wants to disframe the image. There are cultures in which the rectangle is less tyrannical than in Europe. In the history of cartoons, there were subtle, inventive uses of the frame. Here, Saint-Fond, the author of Décatine, had this idea. Gave very varied forms. In the Epinal images, we have a floating image without a frame. There's been a documentary on the history of cartoons and bande dessinée. We can see in many cases a character who gets out of the frame and he can move onto another frame. This is how the subversion of a certain form has led to not the contrary form, but has kept the same form, inventing a certain game with the original archetypes. Most cartoonists stick to the frame, but they subvert it once in a while. You can have a bridge from one rectangle to the other. Now I come to the third image, the rule. Regula. In Benveniste, very important book, Vocabulary of Indo-European Institutions, he discusses not Rex as chief, but the person who decides which spaces are consecrated. Rego comes from the Greek orego. Orego means to extend in a straight line. Orego in a right straight line or in breadth. Starting from where you are, one direction or the other. origo. From the point where you are, you mark a straight line ahead. He pulls out the lines forward from the observer. There's a beautiful image in Homer with origo. Horses stretch out their full length as they bound ahead. From this root of rego, you guess there's the word regio, the region or the point reached following a straight line, hence regula, the instrument used to draw a straight line. That epistemological process authorizes what I consider to be an enlightening link, rule between rule and territory. Territory, regio, region, that can be attached to an enclosure, but it's closer to rule. In Robinson Crusoe, there's the moment he decides to get organized. He does two things at once. First, he designs the site for his house. He marks out the plot for his house and then fixes upon a way of organizing his time, so timing, a life rule. He gives himself a regula. We can recall here that there is the territory that is generated, the ethological notion of the territory. Territory, we've seen, is appropriated space for animals, is protected from intruders, other animals. It can be man, robins, deer. Each animal rules over his or her domain, but it is associated with recurrent functions. It's defined as a place for reproduction, breeding, preening, mating, nesting. We see this with warblers, robins. At times it's only used for reproduction and nesting. Rivals confront each other at the boundary. This is the case for peewits. And it can only be the nest and the few square decimeters surrounding it. And there are territorialities that last all year round, like the robins, others that are temporary, only during the breeding season. If we shift to the human plane, we go back to the notion of a domain. For instance, in Robinson Crusoe, he creates a domain. He has a fortress, that's his home. He has two rooms for grain. He has a country house. He has a field for the cattle. He has a mooring place for the canoe. Daniel Defoe himself had the same principle. He had a comfortable house in Stoke Newington with tables, orchards, a garden. In the Magic Mountain, we have two spaces, the flatland and people high up who are subjected to rules, people who are sick, who have to follow regula, the rule. In Potluck, we have problems of territories, two overlapping spatial divisions. On the one hand, masters versus servants, with the different courtyards, the kitchen courtyard, the sewer courtyard, where insults exchange, the domain of the masters is divided vertically, since standing is important. At that time, the higher up you are, the you were less respectable. Money was connected with respectability and the number of stories. All these domains are associated with life rules. The generic function of the territory, it's worth reminding ourselves, is not just a matter of security. It has to do with the constraint of distance. The spacing of subjects inside one territory in case of danger. For instance, schools of fish, individuals can move into that. Once the danger has passed, the subjects re-establish their distance from one another. This is the idea of getting back to one's distance. The notion of critical distance governing the relations between individuals. One function of the rule is to stage that critical distance. Any system of rules metonymically regulates a territory, either as temporal, timing, or physical, gestural behaviors. Here can be posed the link between the question of the link between rule and custom. Rule is a system of habits, of habitual behaviors, with an active emphasis. The regular is a system of habitual behaviors. The rule can be very constraining. It has an origin in custom. It can oppose, at the beginning at least, law and rule. At first, the rule was just custom. We saw this at the beginning in monastic rules. Saint Basil, Saint Augustine, Saint Benedict, Saint Anthony had no rules, only customs. Of course, the rule functioned as an instrument of control. It's connected with the Greek meaning of askesis, the castrating methodical effort at control, a methodical effort. It's not limited to mortification. It's the idea of regulating, the idea of controlling, directing time, desires, spaces, objects. In that implication of mastery, we rediscover the etymological root in origo, rule, the way of stretching time in a straight line, like the image of Homer's horses that fits with the paradoxical idiosyncratic rule of idiorhythmy. Stretching out your full length in a single bound. Such is idiorhythmical time. It's a regular time, but it bounds, it rebounds. Third, there's the custom rule. It will start moving in the direction of a repressive system. This is what you find with the contract. In the 6th century, Saint Benedict says that after a one-year novitiate period, you have to establish the vows. The young monk will establish a bilateral contract, a contract between the community and the monk who has just professed. It gives, of course, security, which is precious at the time, if we compare with job security today. It provides security in exchange for obedience to the rule, with the notions of infraction, punishment. Already, Pacomius' successor monks were asked to sign a declaration of obedience to the rules. They would say no rule, but there was already a law. From the moment the rule is set down as a contract, you have the possibility of an infraction, of disobedience, and of punishment, and the unhappy cycle is established. The successor of Pacomius, Kenudi, ruled over a group of monasteries, and he couldn't help drawing up a list of infractions. It was forbidden to leave the monastery, and forbidden to escape at night to converse with banished monks, forbidden to take excessive care of one's toilet, stealing sweets from the infirmary, keeping a portion of objects made for parents and friends for oneself. All these were prohibited. We can see here the boarding school, army barracks, the factory. They were all in there. Under rule, law returns with an irresistible force. It's as if there were a drive for law. within the human subject. It's an ideological drive, a paradoxical drive. It's the ideological counterside of power. It's very well expressed in that novel I mentioned a few times, Lord of the Flies, Golding, story of a group of children who are stranded on a desert island after their plane has crashed. As soon as the children feel they are on their own, they are their own masters, there is immediately a shift from a state of nature to a state of rule, and so of law. Jack, who is the leader, seeing they are alone, he immediately shouts, "We'll have rules, lots of rules." Then, when anyone breaks them, another example, the community connected with the problem of drugs. In the US, a few years ago, there was in California a community, Synan. It had 200 girls and boys, all coming from drug addiction. It was organized like a phalanstery with precise rules. You saw the transformation of the rule into the law. In that community, they were forbidden to make love. Only after a certain time, in some bedrooms reserved for the purpose, then you had couples. The rule was transformed into a law. You can see the articulations. You see the opposition between the rule and regulation. The rule is an ethical act. In certain cases, a mystical act, whose aim, I repeat, is to give a transparency to everyday life. It's an individual act, but in small communities, it can be shared. When stipulations are not too strict, they establish shared habits that gradually become the norm. The rule belongs to the unwritten. It's an important distinction for law discussions, the written and the not written. Laws are always written. The privileged space of the rule is precisely idiorhythmic. If we want to imagine an idiorhythmic utopia, small community of friends, for example, it means that there is the imagination of a rule and not a regulation. That would be the fundamental problem. That would be the condition for success. A rule without a regulation. A regulation is, of course, the imposition of the social as power. It's often mediated by writing. Writing is where the law gets inscribed, the written law. If you allow me I'll take 3 minutes to finish. The dividing line between the rule and the regulation can be observed in two extreme and contradictory practices. First, in Sade's universe, the Sadean world is based on the opposition that's perpetually actualized between rule and regulation. One can see this very well. Gentlemen, the libertines, apply a rule between themselves. It's based on mutual consent. It's based on the possibility of repayment. You consent to do for someone what they consent to do for you. And then the victims, they are not submitted to the rule, but to regulation. And this is merciless, and it is written in the 120 days of Sodom, you have a regulation of the pleasures. It serves the masters. It's a regulation applied to the others. The aristocracy is the paradise of the pleasure of the rule as opposed to the hell of regulation. This is the extreme gap between rule and regulation. At the opposite extreme, there is a critical thinking that sees every rule as containing a regulation in itself, the seeds of a regulation. I can think of Brecht's motto, under the rule, discover the abuse. It's in this play, he who says yes, he who says no. I wanted to use that in my book on mythology. Under the rule, discover the abuse. Here, the rule is in another meaning, the network of ready-made opinions, stereotype behaviors, it dictates the social behavior. Perhaps, after a certain period of time, every rule, even an inner one, becomes abuse. Perhaps at certain points in one's life, it's necessary to shake up one's rule. In every community, in every group, there is a grand custom, a use insidiously established. I have to shake it up. Shaking up the grand custom, that become incomprehensible, unreadable. This is what you see in literature, in Dostoevsky's Brothers Karamazov, the Tsarets Zosima, and the youngest brother, Alyosha. You remember that Alyosha's qualities to become a monk. His health, purity, modesty, he's not judgmental, he's not seduced by material goods. All this predestined him for the monastic state. But there is a scandal against the grand custom. The Tsarets Zosima, on his deathbed, urges Alyosha to live in the world. to get married, not to be a monk. It's so scandalous, this behavior, that this episode has triggered a protest of Anthony, who represented young Russian monks at the beginning of the 19th century. He said this: here, under the pretext of pedagogy, Dostoevsky committed a veritable sin against the truth. On no account would the father of a monastery have sent a novice as ardent as Alyosha Karamazov out into the world. We see the two voices, the oppressive voice of the grand custom. That's how we do things, that's how we do not do things, as opposed to Zosima, the solitary voice of mystical rule. Next time, we'll talk about... Okay. I don't know.